Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. We're coming to you from Las Vegas at the UNLV Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies. And today we're going to be speaking with first Sandy Garasino and next Stephen Cobb, a security evangelist of ESET, the security company. And Sandy, you are first up here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
And Sandy is a former Crown prosecutor and from Vancouver, BC, in Canada. And we were going to discuss a letter that was issued to Facebook, to Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, and the Facebook board of directors by the Global Alliance Against Minor Exploitation. And a short version is GAME, G-A-M-E, kids.org. And they have tried to engage with Facebook for many months. And so this is a letter that was sent at the end of October. The main things they do a brief review of their history of how trying to get Facebook to respond to reports of violent pages and various things. And it covers a number of topics. The existence on Facebook of convicted and registered sex offenders, cyberbullying of children, unauthorized RIP, rest in peace, or memorial pages, adult trolls and cyberbullies, Facebook Safety Advisory Board, child sexual abuse and exploitation content, and whether it is a tech or a media company subject to the same principles and standards as any other media company. So, Sandy, what offhand do you make of this letter, and has Facebook responded to it?
As far as I am aware, Facebook has not responded. This is a very, very comprehensive review of the challenges and difficulties that not only Facebook but all social media faces with having child users or minors on the networks, on the sites and platforms. It's actually, I strongly encourage everybody to have a look at it. It's on Glenn Canning's page. Glenn Canning is the father of Rehtaeh Parsons. Carol Todd is a signatory to this. Amanda Todd's mom, of course. Other parents of children who have died. It's really worth everyone having a look at, because it gives a comprehensive view of the issues that are facing families and kids and facing technology. But as far as I am aware, and I put in a note to Jay Marshall, who is the person behind this organization, the lead person, and he's in Hong Kong. As far as I'm aware, to date, there has been no response from Facebook.
Well, that's disappointing, I guess not terribly surprising, given their past history of attempting to get some response about this. And I see this mainly as an attempt to present reality in contrast to what Facebook people continue to present as the case, when really the signatories of the letter, of course, are people who have had personal experience on trying to report objectionable content, and to no avail over the period of months or perhaps even years.
Sandy, Jim Nico here. Again, welcome to the Social Network Show.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. One other thing, too, I just wanted to mention, too. I wrote a provocative and honest and humble letter post on our blog at the socialnetworkstation.com facebook.com. And I think you might have seen it. But anyway, it's the one where I challenged or invited, rather, Mark Zuckerberg to debate me on the social network show. In that particular post, I built up to the letter. The letter is also there in full, as well as Red Hood Project and Carol Todd, et cetera. So just for our listeners, if they want to go and see who else is in support of this letter from GAME, including you, they can go to thesocialnetworkstation.com/blog.
The first thing they cover, this is what is interesting to me, is that, as you say, it's very comprehensive, and there's not just one problem here. The first thing they cover is the existence of profiles put up by convicted and registered sex offenders. Now, given the number of young people on Facebook, any age people, why would this be, to ask a really naive question, why would this be objectionable? What is the fear and the reality of these people being on Facebook?
Well, it's very interesting because the example that they provided, one of the key examples was a person who's a registered sex offender, convicted of two child sexual offenses, and using Facebook to publicize and further his religious work with children. So to promote himself and hold himself out as a figure offering guidance and assistance to children, not only in the U.S. but also abroad. This is the problem, is that people are not merely on Facebook and participating in the Facebook community. And in some respects, I guess we want to feel like everybody can participate. But the use of Facebook as a platform, as an unfiltered and unsupervised platform for contact between adults and children, is just deeply offensive. So it's the failure of Facebook to ensure that its platform is being used responsibly and to responsibly monitor it. That is the key component here. The other aspect, of course, we keep coming back to this, is that there is no identity verification process required for users of Facebook unless they are challenged. So, I mean, what's amazing here is that these people who were actually known registered sex offenders use their real names, but there's nothing to stop any of the several hundred thousand in the United States and goodness knows how many millions around the world from just using Facebook and using fake identities to promote and to gain contact and access to kids.
Right, so this is actually an active part of their luring children and connecting with them. It is especially ironic to me to read in the Facebook Guide for Educators that everyone on Facebook is a real person and that people will not do things when they know that they are identifiable. And, I just wonder what planet are they on? I don't understand. Jim understands it. Yes,
yeah.
Jim.
Well, yes, and I just wanted to point out that being privy to various and ongoing brilliant communications from GAME to Facebook, this being one of many, many communications that I'm aware of, and I know you are, Sandy, is that I think the most bottom line to this letter is that GAME and all the people, the signatories, et cetera, the tone of it, and I hope everyone reads it because it is very important, but the bottom line is that they're asking now, I mean, they've been trying to get Facebook to wake up to this reality and deal with these problems for so long, with so many of us trying to help them do this, okay, to get to the bottom of this and fix this problem, that it, in the letter, it's now saying we want government intervention to come in. Because, you know, this is, we've had it with you, Facebook. We've tried to be, you know, honest, nice, and understandable, and now it's crisis proportion. Kids are dying, et cetera, et cetera.
Because it has become abundantly clear that there's really no intention to change or address these
problems?
As far as
I can tell, I can't see intention to change.
And what I think is I don't think that there is intention to change, because the change that would be required would actually have a major impact on the business model of Facebook. And they are so keen, and all the social networks are, because these are actually, if you think about it, this is an industry that's in its infancy. Even as powerful and as dominant as Facebook is, it is still a platform that is forming itself. It is forming where its place is going to be in the world, how it's going to use the data that it is mining from all of us, and including our kids. And they have a huge, from their perspective, they have a huge job in front of them just to build this company. And what the public is demanding, what we are demanding, it would throw a huge spanner into the works. So that, I think that's the real challenge. And this is just this tension between public demand for a proper product for consumer responsibility or for consumer protection, and the demands of investors and the demands of businesses that they just drive those revenues, that they get those, capture that revenue as fast as they can. And they are also in competition with competitors, and they do not want to be supplanted. And they understand very clearly that a major platform overhaul that would require identity verification would probably spell the end of their competitive advantage.
Well, unless, of course, it were, and I don't see any reason it wouldn't be applied equally to their competitors. So that is,
that's legislation, isn't it?
Yeah, it would need to be. We're going to carry on in our next segment on the other factors that are involved in the letter, and some of the realities of what it means to have a business. A business model basically is your way of making money. How are you planning to make money with this business? And the responsibility to factor in some of the costs, the realistic costs that you would need to have a legitimate business. So we'll be discussing that up next.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
What could make you eager for a trip to the dentist? Well, what if it meant a trip to Las Vegas? With USC training and 18 years of experience, your Las Vegas dentist is expert in fillings, root canals, crowns, veneers, implants, and clear braces. Dr. Naheed Mohammadi's office is easy to get to from the Las Vegas Strip. Dr. Mo strives for long-lasting solutions with quality materials and superb workmanship. Find her online at NevadaSunDental.com. To schedule, just dial your country's exit code, often 00, then 1-702-898-0800. Whether you speak English, Spanish, or Farsi, you'll feel right at home, and of course, locals are welcome. 702-898-0800.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
You're back with the Social Network Show, and we're speaking with Sandy Garasino from Vancouver, BC, on the topic of the letter of written by Global Alliance Against Minor Exploitation, or GAME, and Game for Kids. and it is an open letter to Facebook. Now, I want to just repeat, because I don't think we're going to be able to get to a thorough discussion of all of them, but we are talking about the cyberbullying of children and adults, adult trolls and cyberbullies, and along with the cyberbullying of children, of course, because of the suicides involved, many are putting up memorial pages. And that was something that rose to objection in the letter. Sandy, what can you tell us about that type of page?
Well, of course, we've seen examples of it with Amanda Todd, where there have been multiple false starts, as it were, people putting up fake identities, putting up... There were even people, I think, that Carol had to deal with, Carol Todd had to deal with, where people were pretending that Amanda was still alive and that they were Amanda. It's just shocking and abusive. People thinking it's very funny to be abusive towards children who have taken their own lives, who've been driven to take their own lives. On the letter, the game letter, is a screen capture of a Rutea Parsons, a terrible abusive page about Rutea Parsons. It's almost as if, in addition to the just the unbelievable tragedy of loss of a child, a loss of a child to suicide, loss of a child to suicide after having been traumatized by social media itself, and then for families to have to cope with and deal with abusive, huge amount of abusive behavior. It's beyond imagining. And what's astonishing to me is how long it took for Carol Todd to even establish any kind of contact relationship with Facebook. I would have thought that the parents and the families who are having to deal with these kinds of tragedies, that Facebook would be making a major effort to reach out to these families, to apologize for one thing, at the very least, and then to accommodate them in any way possible. Even it took us 9 months or so, we were finally able to, Red Hood Project was finally able to connect Carol Todd with senior management with Facebook, and things have got much better. But even when we've had that contact and we've been reporting pages, they still revert back to, in some cases, well, this isn't really necessarily about Amanda, or, you know, a page that's about drink bleach. Ha ha ha. That's not really about Amanda, or this is about freedom. There's a freedom of speech issue. I mean, really.
Yeah.
Really.
And then to refer to the page did not violate our community standards. So they have community standards. So a community standard to me is a standard of, I would say, decency, and yet it's almost as if that word has gotten some negative connotations, you know, of people trying to, I don't know, foist their standards on other people. And yet, if you have community standards, what else is that? It's a standard that the community has agreed upon that they're not going to fall below. But, you know, unless it's so low that anything can get through. But that is another issue with those pages, such as, you know, some start out as a legitimate memorial page, but then are forgotten or hacked, or they become overrun with spam and trolls and so forth, and they just become more abuse, you might say, of someone who, even after their death. The adult, you know, it's good to remember that this is not limited to children. In fact, yeah. Some of the earliest cases of cyber abuse and cyber assault, I would call it, were against people who, you know, adults, and many times women, but actually driving them out of their livelihood, which was on the web. So the issue of not being able to, like you say, not being able to reach into the wizard behind the curtain, you know, who is running Facebook, how do you get some human on the other end of the line to consult about this. And when you're talking about the business model, Sandy, I think I see more clearly now that you're talking not just about the amount of money it would cost to put on more moderators, to have a phone line for extreme cases and so forth. It's not just the expense, but it's more fundamental than that. And you're saying it's because they want to get as many users as possible, regardless of the quality. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, one of the things that I'm very certain of is that if Facebook required ID verification, their supposed 1.1 or 1.2 billion active users, that number would drop by hundreds of millions, because so many people have multiple identities on Facebook, and the people who are malicious in their use of multiple identities don't have one or two, they have 10 or 20
even,
or more.
Yeah, so, even thousands.
So when Facebook is holding itself out to marketers as an advertising platform, it is claiming to have a certain number of eyeballs. It's claiming to have a certain viewership or usership. And if it were required to verify, I think that would have a big impact on advertisers. It would have a big impact on market share and on its share valuation. Analysts would seriously question, is it going to be able to retain the advertising dollars that it's dominant in the marketplace that it's got right now?
The Sandy Garasino series on the Social Network Show. I remember in a former or previous episode, Sandy, you pointed out brilliantly, I might add, that we are the product. Those of us, I'm not on Facebook, but those of people that are, can you embellish on that? Who's the product? Who's the customer, please?
The way the Facebook business model works, and the business model that all social media platforms hope to, or that they aspire to, is that they can monetize all of these free users, because we are all using this product. We're on it for free. So where do they get the money? They get the money from advertising dollars, from advertisers, from marketers. Not only from advertisers and marketers. Remember that these platforms are farming data, and in particular, Facebook is an incredibly powerful data mining platform, more so than almost all the other social media, because of the richness and the depth of the material they are collecting. Every time anyone clicks that they like a posting, every time they share a posting, they are creating a fingerprint that helps to identify their desires, their wishes, what they like, what they don't like, and everything that they comment on. This material is all being gathered, and it is creating an incredibly rich profile of the consumer that marketers will pay huge dollars to acquire. So it is not only about having eyeballs on the page. So when you're looking at Facebook, and I think we're all, those of us who use it, are all starting to see more and more advertising. That's only part of it. It's also the selling of the data that is being mined from us and from our children. Without people's real knowledge of how extensive that data is. I mean, one example, if I could just lead in with one example, the Obama campaign was able to determine that they used this data with microscopic, electron microscopic accuracy to pinpoint exactly who the swing voters were and how to reach them, where they were, what their preferences were, and what they wanted to see.
Right, and to send someone to contact them that had interests in common, and therefore would have more credibility with the undecided voter. Yeah, that was very, very interesting situation also. The Last point I want to just briefly discuss on the letter, and there's more that we can talk about next time, was the Facebook Safety Advisory Board. And we only have about a minute left, Sandy, but for that, could you tell us how do advisory boards to corporations generally work? What is the gold standard? How should they work?
There are a variety of different models, but effectively one of the things that's so important for an advisory board is real independence from the organization. That's very difficult to achieve when the organization that you're serving is so powerful, and just by associating with them, you raise your own profile and your own power and influence in the community. So there's an automatic conflict that is just built in that's hard. But in particular with regard to Facebook, and I believe this is true with some of the other platforms, it's my understanding that Facebook Advisory Board members sign a non-disclosure agreement, so they are not really at liberty to disclose publicly what issues they're talking about and what positions they've taken. And that compromises their independence as well.
Mm-hmm. And so that is not typical to have an NDA or non-disclosure agreement?
Well, I'm reluctant to comment on that because I'm not broadly familiar across all industries. I think it's probably somewhat common, but it does create the conflict, especially when children are involved. And certain members, Common Sense Media was originally on the Facebook Advisory Board, and it's my understanding that they withdrew because they would not sign the non-disclosure agreement.
Mm-hmm. So there is some compromising that is built into this program. Well, let's discuss this the next time we get together, and we'll look forward to your next visit with us on the Social Network Show. And we have been talking with Sandy Garasino of Vancouver, British Columbia, and co-founder of RedHoodProject.com. Thank you, Sandy.
Thanks so much.
Hear archived shows at thesocialnetworkshow.com. Follow us on Twitter at SocialNetShow or TSN Station. The Social Network Show will be right back.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show. And we're welcoming our guest now in this segment, Stephen Cobb, a security evangelist of ESET. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Stephen.
Very good to be here.
Thank you for making time for us. And I wanted to know if you could just give us a brief description of the company, ESET.
Yeah, so ESET is best known as an antivirus company, anti-computer virus. It's based in Slovakia, in the capital there, Bratislava, and it's actually been around for over 20 years. The technology was developed originally in the early days of computer viruses by some students in Slovakia, and they started a company after the shall we say, after the Russians left Slovakia and it became split off from Czechoslovakia and became its own country. They have now a presence in 180 countries around the world. There are about 100 million or more users of the product. The company has about 900 employees. And I'm talking to you from San Diego, which is the North American headquarters of ESET. And we take care of the sales, marketing, and support for the ESET products in North America. And that's ESET Antivirus, ESET Smart Security, and ESET Two-Factor Authentication.
Okay, well, thank you. And what I appreciate is that you have, the company has commissioned some surveys, a Harris survey recently, of U.S. adults. And we found, you found that 82% of them now are using social media. But I do have a question on that. It was called an interactive survey. So does that possibly give you some kind of selection bias there on things we're going to talk about here? Is it, was it only people who were online that were taking the survey?
Yes, the survey is an online survey. So that percentage is the number of people who use the internet who are using social media.
Okay.
The survey was done by Harris Poll. So, yeah, it's a very, should I say, it's a sophisticated survey of over 2,000 adults, American adults who use the internet.
Okay. And it found that more than half of the U.S. adult users of networks have not read the most recent privacy policy for their social media accounts. Now, how realistic is it to expect people to actually read those privacy policies?
Well, I take your point that we have been in recent years bombarded by privacy statements and privacy policies, everything from our bank accounts to our doctor, doctor's office, and so on. The thing that concerns us about social media and privacy policy is that if there is a change to the privacy policy on the social network that you're using, be it Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or Google Plus, that could mean that more of your information is available to the world, or certain aspects of the sharing that you're doing on social media may have changed. And that was the case, you know, this year we've seen where Facebook made everybody's profile searchable, and Google indicated that it would be using people's endorsements of products in product reviews. And so we do think that if you're going to read privacy policies, that the social network that you're using, you need to know the policy there, and particularly if there are changes to it. So one of the things we find with social network behavior is people sign up and they just use it.
Right.
They don't think about any of the settings. So one of the findings that was interesting to us was that there are people who've never actually adjusted the privacy settings on their social media.
Mm.
And that's of concern because obviously, things like Facebook depend on ad revenue, which comes partly from the amount of sharing of information that's done there. So when you join a social network, the default settings are typically ones that are fairly open.
Right.
And so we encourage people to look at their settings and see what they are sharing and with whom.
Right, and it's sort of the background of all of what we're discussing here was that the opening question of the survey was, who do you think is most responsible for your online safety? And the individual said, oh, well, we are, more so than saying the ISP or the social media itself, regulators and so on. But if this isn't the default settings are a case in point to me where the social media itself, the social network administrators, owners, and so forth could go a long ways toward promoting safety and security online if the default was not so open? Now, do you think there's any motivation for them to do that?
Well, that's a very good question, because it sort of pits the concerns of the individual against the sort of perhaps the business plan mm-hmm. of the social network. I mean, I do think that, you know, different social networks have different approaches, and you know, they are struggling to create a suitable balance between the amount of sharing that people do and the amount of ad revenue that they can generate by targeting people according to their interests. So, you know, just so listeners understand how this works, is for somebody who wants to advertise a product, being able to direct that ad at somebody who has exactly that kind of thing in mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, I like kayaking, say, and so if you've got kayak tours in San Diego, you might want to get a hold of me. Well, if you can see that I'm in San Diego and I like kayaking, then it is really valuable to you if you operate kayak rentals to get an ad to me. And there are various ways of doing that, which can be done without really revealing a lot more information about me. But, you know, companies are working on getting that balance right. I think the question about the default setting is an interesting one, because what we see with a lot of computer programs, and in the end, you know, a social network is a computer program, is a lot of people don't change the initial settings. So I think if you were to open up a new social media network where the default was not to share anything, then there wouldn't be much interaction. and so, you know, I think there's a case for saying, you know, maybe the default should be just to share with friends,
mm-hmm.
but then I think it would be reasonable for the social media network operator to encourage people to share more if they wanted to.
Right, and that would promote making it easy and open and transparent, as opposed to now, if to change it is actually contrary to the business interests, there's really no motivation to make it user-friendly and to make it easy for people to adjust or to understand. So I know that ESET has a free social media scanner. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. So I clicked on it. And like most apps, it gave me that message that it is going to require me to authorize it to follow new people, update my profile, post tweets for me. This was to Twitter, and access my direct messages. Now, why on earth does ESET need to do that in order to give me a free scanner?
That's an excellent question, Dr. J. It really points to one of the dilemmas around privacy and security. A lot of people are familiar with antivirus software, and hopefully are using it on their computers, on their laptops, to protect them from infection by viruses and Trojan horse code mm-hmm. and other mm-hmm. nasty things out there. In order to do that, the antivirus program has to have complete access to the system. And historically, that hasn't been an issue, because the software is, it's designed to protect me. And it's like the people who run the alarm system in your home. They have access to your home mm-hmm, to protect
mm-hmm,
you.
Right.
The issue around an application, an app, for Facebook asking you for permission to do things is a similar thing. We need to be able to scan what is on your pages and on your updates and so on, and we need to be able to communicate that. And so, unfortunately, the way that those things are framed in the permissions it does look like, oh my gosh, they want to, you know, they want to take over my account.
I've had
this conversation with people, and I've looked at this issue around other applications, and what it means when an application says we want to be able to to post as you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the ones you see that on Twitter with a Twitter app. Mm-hmm. If you sign up through a website to do comments, for example, via Twitter, it says, we want to be able to post on your behalf.
Yes.
It's not that they're going to go and say things about you to somebody. It's the ability to communicate with you through that system. And we have a number of ways that we do that. For example, and you can actually turn off some of these things as well. For example, I can choose to be alerted to problems. I can choose to alert my friends to problems that the scanner finds on their stuff, or I can turn that off.
Okay. Listen, I want to continue with this because I'm not quite convinced yet, and we'll do that in our next segment.
Want to be a guest on The Social Network Show? Email us at guest@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
What could make you eager for a trip to the dentist? Well, what if it meant a trip to Las Vegas? With USC training and 18 years of experience, your Las Vegas dentist is expert in fillings, root canals, crowns, veneers, implants, and clear braces. Dr. Naheed Mohammadi's office is easy to get to from the Las Vegas Strip. Dr. Mo strives for long-lasting solutions with quality materials and superb workmanship. Find her online at NevadaSunDental.com. To schedule, just dial your country's exit code. Often 00, then 1-702-898-0800. Whether you speak English, Spanish, or Farsi, you'll feel right at home, and of course, locals are welcome. 702-898-0800.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to The Social Network Show, and we're talking with Stephen Cobb, the Internet Security Evangelist for the company ESET. And we've been discussing the rather threatening sound of the posts or the screen that shows up when you sign up for an app, and talking about why is it necessary to authorize an app to update, for instance, your Twitter profile. Stephen, what is the logic behind that?
Okay, so first of all, I think it's important to bear in mind that, you know, different apps ask for different permissions. And when you see that request, whether it's a new Twitter connection or a new Facebook app, you really do need to read those and see what they're doing. Sometimes, though, it looks more scary, shall we say, than it is. It's a question of proportion and appropriateness. So if, for example, I'm downloading a game, and the game says I want to send tweets on your behalf and change your profile, I'm probably going to say, well, I don't need that to play a game, surely. But in the case of what we were discussing earlier, the ESET social media scanner, mm-hmm. which is designed by a security company to keep you more secure, the one of the scarier questions is, we want permission to change your profile. The reason for that is, within the media scanner, we have something called a security center, which gives you a better way to adjust your privacy settings on Facebook. So as you had mentioned earlier, the settings within social media around privacy and security can be very complicated. So we've tried to make that a little bit easier. And one of the things that happens with our scanner, if you go to the part of it called the Security Center, we've got this graph or a gauge. Mm-hmm. And it goes from public to private, and there's a needle, and it kind of shows you what it considers. You know, are you a private settings? Have you got public settings? And it actually, in my case, I've just run it, and it says, are you aware that you're sharing where your hometown is? You know, mm-hmm. I was born in Coventry in the UK, and you're sharing your current location. I'm okay with that, but some people might not be, and so this is alerting them to do that, and then it will actually allow you straight from the scanner to change those things. Okay. And that's why it needs permission to access.
And there is a picture of that on your blog, by the way. I want to mention that. It's called WeLiveSecurity.com, and excellent material there. And one of the reasons I think people might not want their hometown is in the United States for Social Security numbers, that there's it narrows for
oh,
hackers,
yes,
narrows the
for
possibilities,
sure,
you know, of what numbers that they need to run through. Now, I want to be sure to get to the issue of online safety training, because you mentioned that in your blog post that many people have not are really kind of flying by the seat of their pants, and in consideration of that are not doing too badly, but there's been no actual training on how to be safe online. Now, whose responsibility or who can step up to accomplish that, do you think?
Well, that is a favorite topic of mine, because I think we all have to step up
okay,
to that. And one of the reasons that I'm at ESET and like being at ESET is that part of my job as a security researcher and as an evangelist around security is that my job is to help educate people, and ESET puts a lot of resources into that. By the way, I'm a security evangelist, not an ESET evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually paid to go out and talk about security to people without even mentioning ESET, because the company has recognized it. I mean, it's been around longer than many others, and it realizes that you can't solve the computer security problems only with technology. I mean, obviously the company does its best to make the best possible security technology, but there's always that human factor. And so we have a number of initiatives that we're involved in. We're a big supporter of the National Cybersecurity Alliance. And as you may recall, October was Cybersecurity Awareness Month. And we had people traveling all over the country to speak at events around that. And we actually did a couple of Twitter chats, which are really cool to do, where people, you know, discuss a topic on Twitter. But also, we a number of years ago kickstarted something here in San Diego called Securing Our eCity, which is a community-wide program. Mainly, it's a nonprofit organization. It's volunteer driven to educate all levels of society, all parts of society. So we have the local police, the city government, local businesses, and organizations like churches and the YMCA, all of whom work to educate their members and their employees about basic security awareness. Because our concern with that number that you mentioned, that the very small number of people who actually have had any security training, is that that's America's workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of our target markets for our product is small to medium-sized businesses. And they have a terrible problem, getting people hired who understand security. So they find themselves as a small business having to invest in educating their employees. My feeling is that, you know, at this stage of the technology, which after all was a lot of it invented in America, kids graduating from high school in America should have a pretty good background in computer security awareness. You know, and there are other countries in the world where kids start learning about online security when they're, you know, in middle school or even earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we work through, you know, lobbying and through our involvement in the community to try and get as much education in as many different places as possible about how to protect information in the digital age. And, you know, one of the reasons that our social media scanner is free is that we find it's a good educational tool. It helps people understand perhaps a bit better than reading the Facebook pages, you know, what makes a difference. And you know, as you point out, we blog about this a lot at welivesecurity.com, where you'll find material there about scams which aren't really necessarily something that our products can do something about. But phone scams, for example, that use the computer, you know, mm-hmm. the scam where somebody calls up and says, you know, I'm from Windows, we hear you have problems on your computer, and it's just a scheme to get you to buy bogus software, you know. And
it's a pretty good bet that anyone they call might have some problems with their computer.
Exactly. And you know, we have to realize that there are people out there who make their living cheating computer mm-hmm. users
yes.
Out of money, and that, you know, they're all over email, they're over the all over the phone, and they're all over social media, you know. And so people need to bear some basic rules in mind. Probably the number one with regard to social media is, if you see something on social media that looks too good to be true, it is. There are no $1,000 Walmart gift cards. And if you see something shocking or horrific, like a famous celebrity has died, don't click on a link on social media to find out about it. Go to a news website. You know, it's not going to be on Facebook that, you know, just Justin Bieber's been in a car crash. Well, it will be. I mean, people will talk about it. But unless you're absolutely sure of the person who's sending you that link, I would, you know, I see something on social media, a news story, I go to Google to check it, Google News or CNN or somewhere, because sensational news is something that the bad guys are good at exploiting. They're good at making it up too, you know.
They want you to click on that, and then what do they do?
Well, they'll do a number of things, one of which is they will send you to a website which, if you've got maybe an Android phone or a Windows laptop, will put malware, malicious software, onto your computer.
Mm.
You know, it's the same strategy as those phishing emails which say, your bank account's been locked, click here,
mm-hmm.
and it takes you to something that looks like your bank website, but in the background, it's putting malicious code onto your system.
Right.
Other reasons they do it on social media, sadly, some people just like to get traffic,
mm-hmm.
Or they like to get likes on Facebook. But, yeah, if it's sensational, be skeptical.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for those good tips. And I agree with you. Everyone needs to step up to the plate. The parents, schools, communities, as you mentioned,
exactly.
And the companies that are in this as a business, I think it behooves them to do what they can to make their privacy settings easy to access and easy to understand and not take a year and a half to read through. Jim.
Stephen, I would like to also thank ESET for allowing you and encouraging you in some way to be here. And we offer our support to help you in any way we can, the company as well as you, to get out the message on how people can be safer and more secure. So we're willing to work with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.